session number 22087, Rule 6. Sorry, Rule 5.
Corporal Weldon, Rule 5. You're explaining to me about making a position for the twin Brownings on the termite hill.
Yeah. That was on this island in the Sundarbans, which was, now then, it was a terrible place. It's very swampy and one thing or another. And the only bit of firm ground was this termite anthill. So we decided that that would be where we fixed the gun. So they dug it all out and we knocked off for lunch. And all these tunnels where the termites, they were all scurrying about, taking all the eggs from one place to another. And the hills were about 4 inches, the holes, the tunnels were about 4 inch diameter. And there was all honeycombed, we didn't cover them. Anyway, when we come back after lunch, they'd all been cemented up. It's just as though a bricklayer had been in and, you know. And we finished up, we'd put the sleepers down and bolted the gun down, and the ammunition boxes and everything was in there. And it was in there for a month or more. And unusually, to our way of thinking, the termites never bothered to attack the wood at all, you know. And yet places when we'd been in, like Secunderabad, I had a wooden box with my clothes in, and the termites had come up through into the box. And what's all this mud on my trousers, you know? And there was like a streak of mud across. And I knocked it off. There was no trousers. And then little devils had built this tunnel, and they work in the dark and eating me trousers. And yet they never bothered us in that gun pit.
Perhaps it was a different sort of wood, or it had been treated.
Oh, I don't know what it was, but I don't know. We'd maybe upset them all and then retreated out the way behind their wall, what they'd built.
Can you remember how many of you there were?
What, on that island?
On that island.
As regards regiment men, there would be half a flight. That would be, what did I say, 20. There'd be 10. There'd be 10 on Charchapley Island and 10 at Culner, plus a couple of corporals and a sergeant on each place, like, you know.
So what would be in a flight?
In a flight, there'd be 20 men in a flight, two corporals and a sergeant. And then if so many flights, then you come on and you have a flight sergeant, because you're building up to a squadron, you see. But for that particular time, was only in flights.
So how many guns would you have each of those islands then? Yes.
On the island, we had just those twin Brownings on a motley stark mountain.
Was it just one outfit?
Twin
Browning.
That's all there was on there. And then we had Brens and Stens and rifles, you know.
Those were personal weapons.
Yeah, and we used to do beach patrol. And the suppliers, the rations, they came in a back cockpit of a Tiger Moth. They used to fly from Calcutta with the rations in the back cockpit. And whoever was on beach patrol was guarding the aircraft. It was a game with us, really, because the pilot, he used to come in and swoop low over the... There was a dak bungalow that had been built, and it was there for the Raj and what have you. It was a tiger hunting place, actually, was that island. It was full of Bengal tigers, and he used to come down and spend time in this dak bungalow, and, you know, in peacetime, go tiger. Well, that was headquarters for the doctor. He was a leading aircraftsman, and there was the CO and what have you. And with us having radar, we had generators, and they run a line from up there, and they had a fridge, so we could cool our bully beef off, you know. Otherwise, they used to pour it out. But it was kept in the fridge, and you could cut it, you know. But it's, as I say, We got supplied by air and landed on the beach, you know. And these pilots who come with these, they were bomber pilots who had ear problems or bad colds, and they couldn't fly at any altitude. So I said, "Oh, your job, take the rations to Charles Chapley." And he'd come down and he'd fly over the Dak bungalow. And as he went over, he'd bomb us with a mail. So they were reading the mail before he got landed, you know. Funny setup, really, but that's the way it went. Anyway, he landed and then took the stuff to the cookhouse, the rations and one thing or another, and he'd go and have a swim. And then he'd come back and he said to me, "Will you give us a hand to start it?" I says, "I'm not swinging that thing." I said, "Chop your hands off." He says, "Oh, I'll do the swinging." He says, "I want you, you work the throttles." I says, "Oh, okay." So I stood on the port side with my hand inside and working the switches and throttles, you see. The chocks, he had to fill up. He brought 4 gallons of petrol with him in 2 gallon tins, and then funnel and a chamois leather. Everything had to go through a chamois leather, because that filtered out. No water will pass through a chamois leather with petrol's going through it. So that was, we always had to do that to make sure there was no water went in the tank, you see. And they said, "Right out, when I say switch off," he says, "switch off. If you don't," he said, "it could chop my hands off," because say the propeller's vertical and it's got to be horizontal so as he can give it a good swing. Well, he's bringing it round and it maybe click over and there are impulse magnetos.
Might start.
It might start, you see. So he says, "Be sure that switches are off." And he says, "And then when I say switch on, you switch on and you say contact." And we did that once or twice and then it fired. And of course he had to gather his ear tins up that he had chucking them. And as soon as he took them from away from the front of the wheels, the aircraft started to move. And he hadn't got in it, you see. Well, I was working the throttles. So I went out to the wingtip and I held the wingtip and the aircraft was going round me, not fast, slowly, you know.
In a circle.
While he was climbing in. Because there's no brakes on a Tiger. And he got in there and I waited till he was pointing in the direction and proper, you know, heading into the wind and that, and let go, and then off he went. And he flew around and shot us up, you know. So that was that episode. And then the next time we had an airdrop, it was supply, it was a Harvard trainer.
That's a bigger aircraft, isn't
that
it?
That was a bigger aircraft, yeah. Then there was, I had to start that thing as well. I says, "How did he go on here then?" He says, "Oh, he gives a starting handle and you stand on the wing and your nose is about that, about 16, 18 inches from the propeller. And you're winding this handle and actual thing, what's happening, there's a little flywheel, and you, it's what you call an inertia starter, and you wind and wind and gradually you build a speed up and you get going until you can't go anymore, and it's, "Oh, I can't go anymore," and he says, "Okay," and he pressed the button and the propeller went about past two cylinders, you know, and it struck up straight away. So give him the handle back, and of course he had to put it away properly because you can't have things flying around when you're in an aircraft, right? And off he went. So that was two aircraft that started up. And we weren't anything to do with aeroplanes, really. We were just ground defence. We, you know, we wasn't credited with any knowledge of anything, but it just happened to be common sense.
What sort of beach was it? Was it a flat beach?
It was a lovely, it looked like graphite. Did the sand, you know, beautiful silvery, you know, and there was loads of crabs that used to come out, and their eyes used to lift up. And another thing we did while we was there, we had to measure the time and the height of the water. And as far as we could gather, the reason was they were checking on the, when it was up for us, it was down for somewhere else where they were interested in.
But there was this, the tide you were checking?
Oh, yeah. That was one of our...
Is that jobs. Twice a day, or...?
I just can't remember. I think it depended. You see, the tide alters sometimes. It was at night. Well, they didn't do it at night. So it was only during the hours of daylight. And in the tropics, your daylight never varies hardly. It's always 7 o'clock at night and it gets dark. You don't have the long, like we do here.
Long twilight.
No, it's quick. It's just like somebody switched it off, you know. And because the island was in the east and the sun set in the west, but we used to see the sunrise and the moonrise. And the reason we was on that island was just before, in the dusk, there's a star, a bright star comes up.
Evening star.
The evening star, and it's ever so bright. And these technicians on the island, they'd seen, as they thought, the light shining out of a conning tower of a submarine. But I think in actual fact, when it boiled down, it was this evening star rising, when it was just below the horizon, it gave you that impression that it was a light out of a, you know. So they sent, as I say, 10 men, 10 regiment blokes, to protect the island. I mean, a lot of good we could do, really. But it made them men who was working, you know, the technicians and these here blokes on the radar, they had faith in us, you know.
Made them feel safer. I
made them feel safer, and they worked better, you know.
How many of them were there?
About 30 odd, I think. Not a lot.
Were they making a permanent building, or were they just putting up a temporary?
Oh, no, it was. We were in bashes, that's bamboo buildings, you know, that, like if you've seen it, Adolf Ottman, did you remember that programme? Well, them bashes. Them's exactly what we had. Native built. But we weren't as clever as the natives. They built their houses on stilts, and ours was on the ground. And of course, we were susceptible to flooding and what have you, and I mean, tidal waves and all sorts. But as I say, I weren't there long enough to be in a tidal wave or a cyclone, you know.
Were there any natives on the island?
Oh, yes. There was two or three villages. And I couldn't understand whether there was... They were of us a nice people, but they seemed to be of more or less a Burmese extraction. And yet, the island wasn't in Burma. It was in what is now Bangladesh, but East Bengal. Mm. And the head men and all that there, and the young ladies and the wives and one thing another, they had a very strict moral code they had. Very strict, because one girl had gone astray with one of our blokes, and she was, I don't know what they did to her, but I know it was very vicious, and poor lass, but that was their way, you know. And you'd think, well, you know, they're only but there was, I don't know what the religion was, or they could have been Buddhists or what, I don't know. But if everything was all right and you behaved with no problem, you know. I mean, we put a Christmas show on there in 1943, I think, Christmas. And Maxie, who was a corporal, he'd written this play, and they wanted a frock for one of the blokes to be dressed up as a woman, you know. And it was a comical do, it was, really. I says, oh, I'll get a sarong. I says, I know the... Often down the scrounging round the village, I used to go down there when I went on duty. I knew the head man's son and the rest of them. And they all, underneath their houses that was on stilts, they had looms, and they were busy weaving sarongs, and it was black and red check, about half inch square. And they thought it was marvellous because the Saab was down having a look round, you know. And I said, I wanted a one of these for this play, you see. And oh, it was ad, and I said, oh, can't afford it, no money, you know. And then it transpired that if I wore it, we could lend us it and bring it back after we'd finished. But I had to wear it. Well, you should have seen them. All the village all turned out to see this sab with this sarong going out of the village back down to the camp, you know. Oh dear, that was some laugh.
You were saying that you're always down the village scrounging things. What sort of things could you find?
Oh, there was was short of cigarettes. You know, I couldn't get no cigarettes. Well. Got into somebody down in this village. He'd make you a pipe, and somebody lent him one, and he copied this pipe, and it was a marvellous copy. And there was a wood part, and then what would have been bakelite was buffalo horn, and it looked just as though he'd bought it from a shop. And the tools he had was very primitive, you know, swordfish bone stuff and all such as that. They're clever. And they grew their own tobacco. And it was beautiful. It smelled lovely, but, oh, it did not burn your tongue. It was...
very hot.
Very, very hot, you know. But they used to roll it into cheroots, I think.
How did you communicate with them? Did any of them speak any English, or did
there was
you?
There was an odd one could speak English, but mainly it was signs and the expression on your face, and you know.
Did you manage to pick up any words of their language?
No, not there. Didn't pick any up at all, and I don't think they. I mean, in India, there was Indian Urdu was the communicating language more or less, and we could. Smattering of that we could get by, but it didn't work on the island, didn't that, I don't think. So we were all right. But we always had one, when we was on night duty, we used to do patrolling the beach on a night. And when we did that, the headman, there was two sons, Mawny and Pawny. They were the headman's sons. And one would be on one night and the other on the next night. And I was on one night with Pawny, and he tapped me on the shoulder and he pointed, and I couldn't hear nothing. But he could. And there was a load of bombers going out to bomb Rangoon, and they were passing over. And he'd spotted them and brought my attention to them a long while before, maybe minutes before they was in earshot for me. So their senses was very, very smart, you know.
When you did a patrol, would it be just you and him?
That's
just
right,
two,
yeah.
One. Mm. Was that the usual pattern? One,
yeah,
one RAF man and one Burmese?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or one native?
Yeah.
Mm. Were they armed?
No.
But you were
armed. I was armed, yeah.
What did you normally carry when you were?
You had carry three or three rifle, and I think we had a bandolier with 50 rounds in, and then five of them you'd have in the magazine in the rifle, you know.
Did you ever find anything suspicious on a security patrol?
No. Only you was very wary of. The wildlife that was floating about there was some terrible big, what do you call, snakes. There was cobras and all them, but the big one was, constrictors, pythons.
Pythons?
Aye, 20 foot long, no messing, you know. Because the CO, you know, he said, oh, I would love some snake skin shoes, he said. Well, he was crafty. He could get his snake skins to... He was in with the pilot, you see. He'd get the skin into Calcutta cured and all the rest of it. Well, we couldn't do that. So it was no way we was going to have any snake skin shoes. Anyway, one of our lads, he was a right air, but, you know. So he wants some snake skins for his shoes. Oh, yes, yes, he says. They said, well, I've seen one big enough to make a suitcase. Anyway, they got got the natives to catch this thing and skin it. Well, you should have seen the ribs, you know, thousands of them, you know, and they just chucked it in the swamp there, and then the vultures come and cleaned it all up. But, ah, yeah, it was a big one.
You mentioned tigers. Did you ever see any of those? Or
yeah.
Any of those?
Oh, yeah. Because, I mean, where we was in the billets, we had what we call tatty bashes, which was a toilet, you know. And it was attached to Ferio, you know. And it used to go down, and it was so many yards away from the from where we lived. That was the best way for it. We gets down there. I was going down there one day, and from the other side, between the same path went by the toilets to the main cookhouse, you see. And there was a bloke from the cookhouse looking at me, and I was looking at him, and a tiger poked its head out the long grass. It looked at me and then turned round, and it went back in the doings, and they shouted, "Tiger, tiger, shoot it." I said, "No, bust it." I said, "He lives here." And that was a beauty. I mean, I've seen tigers in the zoo, but nothing to compare with a real live wild one, you know. And he was a beautiful specimen, you know. I looked at, you know.
Did they?
And there was loads of green parakeets, loads of them, you know, flying around.
Did the tigers ever come bothering you? Or
well, there was a case when they did cause a bit of a bother, was when they'd forgot about us with the rations, and we was this squadron or whatever was supposed to supply us with stuff. They all disappeared and we was forgotten, and we was down to a slice of bully beef and a biscuit. Was really hungry, you know. And then they said, "Oh, well, we'll send you some fresh meat from Calcutta." I said, "Well, that's going a bit, is that?" I mean, there was a day on the train and 2 days on the steamer to get to us, you know. They're going to be a bit ripe, is this, you know. Anyway, in actual fact, it turned out it was a goat on the hoof, and that was the meat. And they brought it and they tied it up outside the cookhouse. Poor little thing, you know, all night long. Well, Mr. Tiger, we never thought about tigers. That was what they used for bait when they were tiger hunting, was goats. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, rawr, tiger ate the goat, didn't he? Back to bully beef again. Oh dear.
Did you have the gun position permanently manned? Was it manned 24 hours a day?
No, the gun position, it was mainly covered up. And with it being a radar station, when there was any hostiles about, then it was uncovered, you know, because we got plenty of warning, you see. We was giving Calcutta, I don't know, and that was warning, I think.
Were there many cases where hostile aircraft were picked up?
Two or three raids, then it was frightening to start with. I mean, there was 27, Army 97 Mitsubishis, and they was the size of a Wellington bomber. And they're all in formation coming from, they took off from Makiab, the next island up from ours. And looking at this lot, right, you know, that course drove. Anyway, they went after us. And in fact, I don't think they knew we was there, which was a good job, really.
What did the radar facility look like? What sort of structure was it?
It was, they had a big wooden mast. There was the R mast, that receiving mast, and the transmitting mast. And the transmitted was very, very high voltage, up these two wires up, and it went out. And then it was received on the other one, and there was a... You see, we weren't allowed to see what went on in there. And it came back down and to the oscilloscopes and what have you, and they interpreted what they were seeing. And then it was sent by Morse code, because we had no landlines. It was all Morse code from the wireless shack to Calcutta, like, to filter on there. And then Colner would pick it up, and then they'd send it as well. After, you know, But to us who travelled by boat and rail, things was taking a long while. But to a man in an aircraft, it was a different thing altogether, you know.
I'm just wondering if, you know, if there's anything obvious that could have been seen from the air in the way.
What had happened was the mast wouldn't be very visible because they blended in with the trees. But the R van and the T van and the generator, there was it was a big crossly with the R and T van, and in there were some hand grenades. Well, if there was any likelihood of anybody belonging to the enemy coming to capture this, these grenades was to be thrown in and blow the whole lot up. There was no nobody must ever get to know what's in there, you see. So, and another thing they'd done, they'd built a, you know, these bashers. They'd built a basher over the top of the vehicle so as it looked like a native hut.
Camouflage from the air.
Oh, yeah. And it also helped to keep the sun off, because being metal, it'd be like being in a oven, you know, in there for the men. Terrible.
Was there any sort of a barrier on the ground, as a security perimeter, a wire fence or anything like that?
No,
around the
nothing. Because it was an island on its own. It was 11 miles by 2 was the island. Eventually, on my scrounging days, and I learnt how to use a native canoe, and I had the permission from the headman, if ever I wanted a canoe any time, to take anyone I wanted. But there was no paddles. They all had the paddles in the ruts. And I used to go and get his paddle from back of the door, you know. I said, oh, the wife will... He made us understand that it was all right. His wife would understand that all I was after was the paddle. And I used to wade, you know, down the creeks and what have you, in the mangroves, and sailing along. I used to take my rifle and go down there and find a creek and go down this creek, and then he'd come to the end, and there would be a market selling spices and one thing. Oh, and then see this way, all these natives, you'd see a white man come out, you know, and they'd never seen anybody come out of a canoe before, you know. Oh, yeah. It was on the island at the time of, there was a big battle in Russia. And it was the Battle of the Dnieper Bend, and I'll never forget that, because there was a gang of us. We got a canoe and we was going to the next island to find some cigarettes. And everything went wrong. There was about 4 or 5 of us. The canoe was leaking, so we pulled in the side and we plastered it up with a clay, and off we went again. And we was heading, the tide was coming in as we was going out. And when we come back, it was the opposite way. It was all hard going. And all we got was 10 scissor cigarettes from off this other island, you know. Yeah, it was.
How did you know it was the Battle of the Dnieper Bend at the same time?
Oh, radio. We was well in touch with we had a radio, you see, you know, wireless, because we used to listen to Glenn Miller and all that jazz, you know. And I don't know, it was an old shortwave thing, and it, Golden Gate Radio, you know, that was from the States, like, you know, Glenn Miller and all the jazz, you know, and then the news bulletins, you used to get them. Oh, and All India Radio, that was another thing we got, and that was BBC transmitted to Delhi and then sent on further on, you know.
So you were able to keep in touch with...
What was going on, yeah.
What about what was going on in Burma and so on?
We hadn't a clue.
You hadn't a clue?
No.
So you knew what was going on?
We hadn't a clue, only knew from our mates who'd been bombed and strafed, and there's another hell of a do at Chittagong. They've been bombed and all the rest of it, you know. And so then, as I say, he had to go at Calcutta with these here. And that did cause a big upset, did that, because the natives all panicked. They just left the shops and everything and clambered on the trains, and they were sitting on the roofs, on the buffers, and, you know, oh, it was really panicky, you know. And
The natives on your island, how did they get their living? Were they fishermen or were they farming? Do you know what their economy?